like themselves, they are as harsh as they might be to foreigners. That is all I wish to say about the Jewish schools of thought. When the ethnarchy of Archelaus came under Roman rule, his brothers, Philip and Herod Antipas, continued to rule their respective tetrarchies. Salome had died, leaving to Julia, Augustus's consort, her toparchy, with Jamnia and the palm groves at Phasilis. Later, when, on the death of Augustus, who had been in supreme control 57 years, 6 months, and 2 days, the empire passed to Tiberius, the son of Julia. These two remain undisturbed, and Philip founded the city of Caesarea near the sources of the Jordan in Panias, and Julia's in Lower Gaulonitis, Antipas Tiberias in Galilee, and a city called after Julia in Perea. During his reign, Philip dreamt that an eagle pecked out both his eyes. He summoned his advisers, and when they had given a variety of interpretations, in came, unannounced, the man mentioned above, who used to go round in animal hair and cleanse people in the River Jordan. He began, "Listen to God's message, the dream you had. The eagle, with its ferocious rapacity, represents your own cupidity, the sin that will cost you your two eyes, that is to say, your throne and your wife." Before sunset, Philip was dead, and his throne passed to Agrippa. His wife Herodias then married his brother Herod. This shocked and disgusted all who respected the law, but they dared not take Herod to task. The man we referred to as a savage, and he alone, faced Herod and fiercely assailed him. "You have married your brother's wife in defiance of the law, and just as he died a cruel death, so will divine vengeance bring your life to an end. The judgment of God is inexorable, and you are doomed to die miserably in exile. For you are not raising up seed unto your brother. You are indulging your own lust and committing adultery, considering that he has left 4 children. This attack infuriated Herod, who ordered the man to be flogged and kicked out. But he constantly waylaid the tetrarch and reiterated his accusations, till Herod lost control altogether and ordered him to be killed. He was a strange creature, not like a man at all. He lived like a disembodied spirit. He never touched bread. Even at the Passover feast he would not eat the unleavened bread or pronounce the words, "In thankfulness to God who delivered the nation from slavery, shall you eat this? It was given for the flight, because the journey was made in haste." Wine and other strong drink he would not allow to be brought anywhere near him, and animal food he absolutely refused. Fruit was all that he needed. The whole object of his life was to show evil in its true colors. As procurator of Judea, Tiberius sent Pilate, who, during the night, secretly and under cover, conveyed to Jerusalem the images of Caesar, known as Signa. When day dawned, this caused great excitement among the Jews, for those who were near were amazed at the sight, which meant that their laws had been trampled on. They do not permit any graven image to be set up in the city, and the angry city mob were joined by a huge influx of people from the country. They rushed off to Pilate in Caesarea and begged him to remove the Signa from Jerusalem and to respect their ancient customs. When Pilate refused, they fell prone all round his house and remained motionless for 5 days and nights. The next day, Pilate took his seat on the tribunal in the great stadium and summoned the mob on the pretext that he was ready to give them an answer. Instead, he gave a prearranged signal to the soldiers to surround the Jews in full armor, and the troops formed a ring 3 deep. The Jews were dumbfounded at the unexpected sight, but Pilate, declaring that he would cut them to pieces unless they accepted the images of Caesar, nodded to the soldiers to bear their swords. At this, the Jews, as though by agreement, fell to the ground in a body and bent their necks, shouting that they were ready to be killed rather than transgress the law. Amazed at the intensity of their religious fervor, Pilate ordered the signet to be removed from Jerusalem forthwith. It was at that time that a man appeared, if man is the right word, who had all the attributes of a man, but seemed to be something greater. His actions certainly were superhuman, for he worked such wonderful and amazing miracles that I, for one, cannot regard him as a man. Yet in view of his likeness to ourselves, I cannot regard him as an angel either. Everything that some hidden power enabled him to do, he did by an authoritative word. Some people said that their first lawgiver had risen from the dead and had effected many marvelous cures. Others thought he was a messenger from heaven. However, in many ways he broke the law. For instance, he did not observe the Sabbath in the traditional manner. At the same time, his conduct was above reproach. He did not need to use his hands. A word sufficed to fulfill his every purpose. Many of the common people flocked after him and followed his teaching. There was a wave of excited expectation that he would enable the Jewish tribes to throw off the Roman yoke. As a rule, he was to be found opposite the city on the Mount of Olives, where also he healed the sick. He gathered round him 150 assistants and masses of followers. When they saw his ability to do whatever he wished by a word, they told him that they wanted him to enter the city, destroy the Roman troops, and make himself king. But he took no notice. When the suggestion came to the ears of the Jewish authorities, they met under the chairmanship of the high priest and exclaimed, "We are utterly incapable of resisting the Romans, but as the blow is about to fall, we'd better go and tell Pilate what we've heard and steer clear of trouble, in case he gets to know from someone else and confiscates our property, puts us to death, and turns our children adrift." So they went and told Pilate, who sent troops and butchered many of the common people. He then had the miracle worker brought before him, held an inquiry, and expressed the opinion that he was a benefactor, not a criminal or agitator or a would-be king. Then he let him go, as he had cured Pilate's wife when she was at the point of death. Returning to his usual haunts, he resumed his normal work. When the crowds grew bigger than ever, he earned by his actions an incomparable reputation. The exponents of the law were mad with jealousy and gave Pilate 30 talents to have him executed. Accepting the bribe, he gave them permission to carry out their wishes themselves. So they seized him and crucified him in defiance of all Jewish tradition. After this, he stirred up further trouble by expending the sacred treasure known as Corban on an aqueduct 50 miles long. This roused the populace to fury, and when Pilate visited Jerusalem, they surrounded the tribunal and shouted him down. But he had foreseen this disturbance and had made the soldiers mix with the mob, wearing civilian clothing over their armor, and with orders not to draw their swords, but to use clubs on the obstreperous. He now gave the signal from the tribunal, and the Jews were cudgeled, so that many died from the blows, and many, as they fled, were trampled to death by their friends. The fate of those who perished horrified the crowd into silence. At about this time, Agrippa, son of that Aristobulus who had been put to death by his father Herod, sought an audience of Tiberius in order to accuse Herod the Tetrarch. When the accusation was not accepted, he remained in Rome and made approaches to many eminent men, and particularly to Germanicus's son Gaius, as yet a private citizen. One day he invited him to dinner, and, after entertaining him lavishly, finished by stretching out his hands and openly praying that Tiberius might die soon, so that he could see Gaius, lord of the world. One of his domestics passed this on to Tiberius, who was enraged, and had Agrippa locked up, keeping him in rigorous confinement for 6 months until his own death. He had reigned 22 years, 6 months, and 3 days. Proclaimed Caesar, Gaius released Agrippa and set him over the tetrarchy of Philip, recently deceased, as king. Agrippa's acquisition of this title awoke jealous ambitions in Herod the Tetrarch. Herod's hopes of a crown were inspired chiefly by his wife Herodias, who kept nagging him for his inertia and declared that only his unwillingness to make the journey to Caesar prevented his acquiring a better title. Having promoted Agrippa from private citizen to king, the emperor would surely not hesitate to promote Herod from tetrarch. Yielding to this pressure, Herod came to Gaius, who punished his ambition by banishing him to Spain, for he had been followed by Agrippa, who brought accusations against him, and was rewarded by Gaius with the addition of Herod's tetrarchy. Herod, whose wife shared his exile in Spain, died there. Gaius Caesar's accession to power so completely turned his head that he wished to be thought of and addressed as a god, stripped his country of its noblest men, and proceeded to lay sacrilegious hands on Judea. He ordered Petronius to march with an army to Jerusalem and erect his statues in the temple. If the Jews refused them, he was to execute the objectors and enslave all the rest of the population. But God evidently took note of these instructions. Petronius, with 3 legions and a large body of Syrian allies, began a swift march from Antioch to Judea. Some of the Jews disbelieved the rumors of war. Others who did believe were at a loss how to defend themselves. But soon a shudder ran through them all, for the army was already at Ptolemais. This is a seaside town of Galilee, built on the edge of the great plain and shut in by mountains. To the east, 7 miles away, is the Galilean range. To the south is Carmel, 15 miles distant. To the north is the highest range called the Ladder of Tyre by the natives. The distance in this case is 12 miles. About a quarter of a mile above the town flows the Belus, a very tiny stream on whose banks is the tomb of Memnon. Near this is an area 50 yards wide, which is of great interest. It is a round hollow which yields crystalline sand. A large number of ships put in and clear this out, but the place fills up again thanks to the winds, which as if on purpose blow into it common sand from outside. This is at once converted by the mine into crystal. Still more wonderful, I think, is the fact that crystal, which overflows from the basin, reverts to ordinary sand, a most unusual spot. The Jews, with their wives and children, massed on the plain near the city and appealed to Petronius, first for their ancestral laws and then for themselves. He yielded to the demands of such a formidable crowd, and left the army and the statues in Ptolemais. Then he advanced into Galilee, and, summoning the populace with all the notables to Tiberius, he enlarged on the power of Rome and the threats of Caesar. He demonstrated, too, the unreasonableness of their demands, for when all the subject races had set up the images of Caesar in their cities among the other gods, the Jews alone to object was tantamount to rebellion and deliberate disloyalty. When they pleaded their law and ancestral customs and explained that it was not permissible for a graven image of God, much less of a man, to be placed in the temple or even in some ordinary place in their country, Petronius retorted, "Quite so, but I too am bound to keep the law of my sovereign lord. If I break it and spare you, I shall perish as I deserve. It will be the emperor himself who will make war on you, not I. I am subject to authority, just as you are." In reply, the crowd roared that they were ready to suffer anything for their law. When he had secured silence, Petronius asked, "Will you then go to war with Caesar?" The Jews replied that for Caesar and the people of Rome they sacrificed twice a day. But if he wished to set up the images in their midst, he must first sacrifice the whole Jewish race. They were ready to offer themselves as victims with their wives and children. This reply filled Petronius with wonder and pity for the unparalleled religious fervor of these brave men and the courage that made them so ready to die. So for the time being they were dismissed with nothing settled. During the next few days he got the leading men together privately and assembled the people publicly, and tried first persuasion and then advice. But for the most part he relied on threats, emphasizing the strength of the Romans, the fury of Gaius, and the necessity imposed on himself. Nothing that he could think of had any effect, and he saw that the land was in danger of remaining unsown, for it was at seed time that the crowds had wasted 7 weeks in idleness. So at last he got them together and said, "It is better for me to take the risk. With God's help I shall convince Caesar, and we can all breathe again. If he is exasperated, I will gladly give my life to save so many." Then he dismissed the throng, who offered many prayers on his behalf, withdrew the army from Ptolemais, and returned to Antioch. From there he at once sent a dispatch to Caesar, informing him of his invasion of Judea and the appeals of the nation, and adding that unless he wished to destroy both the men and the land they tilled, he must let them keep their law and withdraw his instructions. To this dispatch Gaius replied in no gentle terms, threatening Petronius with death for his own slowness in carrying out his orders. But as it happened, the messengers who carried this reply were held up for 3 months by storms at sea, while others, who brought news of Gaius's death, had a good voyage, so that Petronius received intimation of this event 4 weeks earlier than the denunciation of himself. When, after a reign of 3 years, 8 months, Gaius was treacherously murdered, the armies in Rome forced the empire on Claudius. The Senate, however, on the motion of the consuls Sextus Saturninus and Pomponius Secundus, ordered the 3 remaining cohorts to protect the city, and assembled in the capital, where, in view of the savagery of Gaius, they voted to take military action against Claudius. They resolved to restore the aristocracy that had ruled the country in olden days, or else to choose by vote a man worthy to be emperor. As it happened that Agrippa was then on a visit to Rome, the Senate sent and invited him to discuss the situation with them, and at the same time Claudius summoned him to his camp to assist him as occasion arose. Realizing that he was virtually Caesar already, Agrippa went to Claudius, who dispatched him as ambassador to the Senate to explain his intentions. In the first place, his hand had been forced by the soldiers, but he felt that to disregard their enthusiasm would be unfair, and to disregard his own future most unsafe. For the fact that he had been summoned to the imperial throne placed him in great danger. He added that he would carry on the government like a good popular leader, not like a dictator. For he was satisfied with the honor of the imperial title, and on every matter at issue he would follow the wishes of the people. Indeed, if he had not been a moderate man by inclination, he would have had a sufficient inducement to self-restraint in Gaius's death. This message was delivered by Agrippa. The Senate answered that they relied on the army and on wise counsels, and would not voluntarily submit to slavery. When Claudius heard this answer, he sent Agrippa back to inform them that he would never consent to betray those who had given him unanimous support, and must therefore fight, though most unwillingly, against those who should have been his best friends. However, they must choose a battlefield outside the city, for it would be sacrilege if, by their folly, they polluted their ancestral shrines with the blood of their countrymen. This message Agrippa conveyed to the Senate. Meanwhile, one of the soldiers with the Senate drew his sword and cried, Look here, you fellows. Why should we think of killing our friends and attacking men just like ourselves who happen to be with Claudius? We have an emperor with nothing against him, and the closest ties with those we are proposing to march against." With these words he strode through the middle of the Senate with his entire unit behind him. Left in the lurch, the patricians immediately panicked, and as they could find no means of escape, they went the way of the soldiers and hurried off to join Claudius. But before the walls they were met by the naked swords of those who had been quicker than they to back the winning side, and the man who led the way might have been in danger before Claudius was aware of the soldiers' violent intentions, had not Agrippa run to him and shown him how dangerous the situation was, pointing out that unless he restrained the violence of his men who were furious with the patricians, he would lose the very people who could make his reign glorious and find himself ruler of a desert. When Claudius heard this, he put a stop to the violent behavior of the soldiery and received the Senate into the camp, making them welcome, and then immediately going out with them to present to God thank offerings for his accession. On Agrippa he at once bestowed the entire kingdom of his forebears, adding the outer districts given by Augustus to Herod, Trachonitis and Aronitis, and also another kingdom called that of Lysanias. The people he informed of this bestowal by an edict. The magistrates he ordered to engrave the award on bronze tablets to be set up in the capital. He then bestowed on Agrippa's brother Herod, who was also his son-in-law, having married Bernice, the kingdom of Colchis. From such wide dominions wealth poured into Agrippa's treasury, which he very quickly emptied, for he began to surround Jerusalem with fortifications so huge that had they been finished, they would have made it futile for the Romans to attempt a siege. But before the wall reached its full height, he died in Caesarea, after 3 years as king, following 3 as tetrarch. He left 3 daughters born to him by Cyprus, Bernice, Mariamne, and Drusilla, and 1 son by the same wife, Agrippa. As Agrippa was quite a child, Claudius brought the kingdom under direct rule again, dispatching as procurator Cuspius Fadus, followed by Tiberius Alexander. These 2 left native customs severely alone and kept the nation at peace. After this, Herod, king of Colchis, died, leaving 2 sons, children of his niece Bernice, Bernicianus and Hyrcanus, and 1 son, the child of his former wife Mariamne, Aristobulus. A 3rd brother, Aristobulus, a private citizen, also died, leaving a daughter, Jotape. The 3 brothers, as I said before, were sons of Aristobulus and grandsons of Herod. Aristobulus and Alexander were born to Herod by Mariamne and put to death by their father. Alexander's descendants established a dynasty in Greater Armenia. In the time of Cuspius Fadus and Tiberius Alexander, many of the miracle workers' followers came forward and declared to the adherents of their masters that, although he had died, he was now alive and would free them from their slavery. Many of the common people listened to their preaching and accepted their call, not because they were men of mark, for they were working men, some only shoemakers, others cobblers, others laborers, but they worked marvelous signs. In fact, nothing was beyond their power. Seeing the unsettlement of the people, these excellent procurators decided, after consulting the scribes, to arrest the men and put them to death, for fear that the movement, though of no consequences at the moment, might end in a major upheaval. But in face of the signs, they hesitated and dared not take any action, convinced that no medical treatment could account for such marvelous cures, and surmising that if these were not the work of God himself, they would soon be shown up. So they gave the man complete freedom of action. Later, however, they were persuaded by the scribes to send them to Rome or Antioch to be tried, banishing others to distant countries. after the death of Herod, king of Colchis, Claudius gave the throne to his nephew Agrippa, son of the first Agrippa. In the other districts which were under direct rule, the procurator Alexander was succeeded by Cumanus, whose governorship was marked by disturbances and further disaster to the Jews. The people had assembled in Jerusalem for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Roman cohort stood on guard over the temple colonnade, armed men always being on duty at the feasts to forestall any rioting by the vast crowds. One of the soldiers pulled up his garment and bent over indecently, turning his backside towards the Jews and making a noise as indecent as his attitude. This infuriated the whole crowd, who noisily appealed to Cumanus to punish the soldier, while the less restrained of the young men and the naturally tumultuous section of the people rushed into battle and, snatching up stones, hurled them at the soldiers. Cumanus, fearing the whole population would rush at him, sent for more heavy infantry. When these poured into the colonnades, the Jews were seized with uncontrollable panic, turned tail and fled from the temple into the city. So violently did the dense mass struggle to escape that they trod on each other, and more than 30,000 were crushed to death. Thus the feast ended in distress to the whole nation and bereavement to every household. This disaster was followed by a further disturbance, the work of bandits. On the Beth Horon High Road, Stephen, a slave of Caesar, was conveying some furniture when bandits swooped and seized the plunder. Cumanus sent out men with orders to bring the inhabitants of the neighboring villages in chains to his headquarters, blaming them for their failure to pursue and capture the bandits. In one village a soldier found the sacred law, tore the book into, and threw it on the fire. The Jews, as if their whole country was in flames, assembled in frantic haste, religious fervor drawing them together irresistibly, and on a single summons ran in their thousands from all directions to Caesarea, where they besought Cumanus not to let the man who had thus insulted God and his law go unpunished. Cumanus, seeing that the mob could only be appeased by a conciliatory answer, agreed that the soldier should be produced, and ordered him to be led between the lines of his accusers to execution. Then the Jews went home. Next came a clash between Galileans and Samaritans. In the village of Gema, situated in the great plain of Samaria, when numbers of Jews were going up to the feast, a Galilean was murdered. This brought swarms of Galileans to the spot to attack the Samaritans. But their leading man came to Cumanus and begged that, before the situation got beyond control, he would cross into Galilee and punish those responsible for the crime. In no other way could the mass of men be dispersed and war avoided. Cumanus, however, made their petitions take second place to matters then in hand, and promised the petitioners nothing. When news of the murder reached Jerusalem, the crowds were infuriated, and abandoning the feast, they instantly set out for Samaria without generals, paying no heed to the appeals of their magistrates. The bandit and revolutionary element among them was led by one Eleazar, son of Dineas and Alexander. These men swooped on their neighbors in the toparchy of Acrobatene and slaughtered them, sparing neither infants nor the aged, and setting fire to the villages. Cumanus, taking from Caesarea one troop of horse, called the Augustans, went to the rescue of those who were being plundered, and rounded up many of Eleazar's followers, killing still more. The rest of the crowd that had set out to fight the Samaritans, the Jerusalem magistrates, rushing out clad in sackcloth and with ashes poured on their heads, besought to return, and not by their vengeful action against Samaria provoked the Romans to attack Jerusalem. They must spare their country and the temple, and their own wives and children, who for the sake of avenging one Galilean were all in danger of being destroyed. These appeals induced the Jews to disperse, but many turned to banditry as there was no one to stop them, and all over the country plundering went on, and the bolder spirits rose in revolt. On the Samaritan side, the leading men went to Numidius Quadratus, legate of Syria, at Tyre, and demanded the punishment of those who had ravaged their land. On the other hand, prominent Jews, among them the high priest Jonathan, son of Ananus, presented themselves and declared that it was the Samaritans who had begun the disturbance by the murder. But blame for what had followed lay at Cumanus's door, since he had refused to take action against the actual killers. Quadratus, for the time being, put off both delegations with the promise that when he visited the area he would inquire into all the circumstances. But he went to Caesarea, and finding there those whom Cumanus had taken alive, he crucified them all. From there he went on to Lydda, where he heard the Samaritan version again. Then he sent for 18 Jews, who were reported to have taken part in the fighting, and cut off their heads. Besides two other men in important positions, the chief priests Jonathan and Ananias, with the latter's son Ananus, and several other leading Jews, were sent to Caesar, as were the most eminent of the Samaritans. He further instructed Cumanus, with Keller, the military tribune, to sail for Rome and report to Claudius what had occurred. After making these arrangements, he went from Lydda to Jerusalem, and finding that the people were celebrating the feast of unleavened bread in an orderly manner, he returned to Antioch. At Rome, Caesar heard what Cumanus and the Samaritans had to say. Agrippa was there too, enthusiastically supporting the Jews, while Cumanus too had many powerful advocates. Claudius found the Samaritans guilty and ordered their three most powerful men to be executed. Cumanus he banished, and Keller he sent in chains to Jerusalem with orders that he should be handed over to the Jews for torture, dragged around the city, and finally beheaded. After this he sent as procurator of Judea Felix, the brother of Pallas, with the addition of Samaria, Galilee, and Perea. From Colchis he transferred Agrippa to a larger kingdom, giving him Philip's old province of Trachonitis, Botania, and Galanitis, together with the kingdom of Lysanias and the old tetrarchy of Varus, he himself, having ruled the empire for 13 years, 8 months, and 20 days, died, leaving his throne to Nero. His wife, Agrippina, had tricked him into adopting Nero as his heir, though he had a son of his own, Britannicus, by Messalina, his former wife, and a daughter, Octavia, whom he had married to Nero. He also had, by Paetina, a daughter, Antonia. Through excess of prosperity and wealth, Nero lost his balance and abused his good fortune outrageously. He put to death in succession his brother, wife, and mother, turning his savage attention next to his most eminent subjects. The final degree of his madness landed him on the stage of a theater. But so many writers have recorded these things that I will pass over them and turn to what happened to the Jews in his time. Little Armenia Nero gave to Herod's son Aristobulus, with the title of king, while to Agrippa's kingdom he added 4 cities with their toparchies, Abila and Julius in Perea, Tarakia and Tiberias in Galilee. Over the rest of Judea he appointed Felix procurator. Felix captured the bandit chief Eleazar, who had been plundering the country for 20 years, with many of his men, and sent them as prisoners to Rome. The bandits whom he crucified, and the local inhabitants in league with them, whom he caught and punished, were too many to count. When the countryside had been cleared of bandits, another type sprang up in Jerusalem, known as Sicarii. These, in broad daylight and in the middle of the city, committed numerous murders. Their favorite trick was to mingle with festival crowds, concealing under their garments small daggers with which they stabbed their opponents. When their victims fell, the assassins melted into the indignant crowd, and through their plausibility entirely defied detection. First to have his throat cut by them was Jonathan the high priest, and after him many were murdered every day. more terrible than the crimes themselves was the fear they aroused, every man as in war, hourly expecting death. They watched at a distance for their enemies, and not even when their friends came near did they trust them. Yet in spite of their suspicions and precautions, they were done to death. Such was the suddenness of the conspirators' attack and their skill in avoiding detection. In addition to these, there was formed another group of scoundrels, in act less criminal but in intention more evil, who did as much damage as the murderers to the well-being of the city. Cheats and deceivers claiming inspiration, they schemed to bring about revolutionary changes by inducing the mob to act as if possessed, and by leading them out into the wild country, on the pretense that there God would show them signs of approaching freedom. Thereupon Felix, regarding this as the first stage of revolt, sent cavalry and heavy infantry, who cut the mob to pieces. A greater blow than this was inflicted on the Jews by the Egyptian false prophet. Arriving in the country, this man, a fraud who posed as a seer, collected about 30,000 dupes, led them round by the wild country to the Mount of Olives, and from there was ready to force an entry into Jerusalem, overwhelm the Roman garrison, and seize supreme power with his fellow raiders as bodyguard. But Felix anticipated his attempt by meeting him with the Roman heavy infantry, the whole population rallying to the defense, so that when the clash occurred, the Egyptian fled with a handful of men, and most of his followers were killed or captured. The rest of the mob scattered and stole away to their respective homes. When this fever, too, had died down, another festering sore appeared in the body politic. The religious frauds and bandit chiefs joined forces and drove numbers to revolt, inciting them to strike a blow for freedom and threatening with death those who submitted to Roman rule. Men who willingly chose slavery would be forcibly freed. Then, splitting up into groups, they ranged over the countryside, plundering the houses of the well-to-do, killing the occupants, and setting fire to the villages, till their raging madness penetrated every corner of Judea. Day by day the fighting blazed more fiercely. Another disturbance broke out round Caesarea, the Jewish settlers coming to blows with the Syrian inhabitants. The Jews claimed the city as their own, on the ground that it had been built by a Jew, King Herod. The Syrians agreed that the founder was a Jew, but declared that the city belonged to the Greeks. Herod would not have set up statues and temples in it if he had meant it for the Jews. These were the arguments put forward by the two sides, and the dispute led to blows, the bolder spirits on both sides daily rushing forth to battle. For the elder Jews were unable to restrain their own partisans, and the Greeks could not bear to be worsted by Jews. The Jews had the advantage in material resources and bodily prowess. The Greeks enjoyed the help of the soldiers, for the greater part of the Roman force there had been raised in Syria, and they were ready to help their own flesh and blood. The Roman prefects, anxious to quell the disturbance, constantly arrested the more pugnacious and punished them with whipping and imprisonment. However, the pains of those arrested failed to check or frighten the remainder, who plunged still more furiously into the rioting. One day the Jews were victorious, and Felix came into the forum and ordered them with threats to retire. When they refused, he sent his soldiers against them and killed a large number, whose property was promptly plundered. As, however, the rioting continued,